Welcome to the deep dive. We are ripping through a massive stack of sources today, from the Fed's tight debates and geopolitical flashpoints, to autonomous AI agents buying pet fish, and the messy intersection of personal finance and policy. It's your shortcut to being instantly well-informed. The specific material we are dissecting, extracting, and exhaustively analyzing is the Wall Street Journal for Monday, December 22nd, 2025. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and I am thrilled to be joined by our expert guide to the material, Sam Astor.
Great to be here. This is one of the densest stacks we've had in a while. It covers everything from global finance, a crucial political succession, and some, you know, deeply personal economic struggles. We're here to give you, the listener, the complete comprehensive picture you need.
Okay, so let's start where the money is, or maybe where it isn't. Washington, D.C., the Federal Reserve, and interest rates, it sounds like the consensus for rate cuts, which, you know, we've seen recently, is facing some pretty serious high-profile dissent from inside the central bank.
That is the core story right now. Cleveland Fed President Beth Hammack, who is a really powerful voice, and importantly will be a voting member of the FOMC next year, is taking a deeply cautious stance.
Okay.
She recently stated there is absolutely no need to change interest rates for several months.
And that's despite the Fed cutting rates at its last three meetings.
Exactly. It immediately sets her up as the key hawk on the committee.
So what's driving her opposition? I mean, those recent cuts were what, 0.75 points total?
Right. Her primary concern is that the Fed is seriously underestimating inflation. She's far more worried about elevated, sticky price growth than she is about, say, the fragility of the labor market.
Which was the whole reason for the cuts in the first place.
Yeah, it was the stated rationale, yes.
Yeah.
But the aha moment here, the real insight, is the nuance she applies to the data itself.
Meaning she doesn't actually trust the official government figures.
She's highly skeptical. Specifically of the reported November Consumer Price Index, which showed inflation up 2.7% year over year. Hammack argues that data collection distortions, ones caused by the government shutdown back in October and early November, likely depressed that official figure.
So she's saying the real number is higher.
She suggests that when you adjust for those known distortions, the true 12-month price growth is probably closer to 2.9% or, you know, maybe even 3.0%.
So the real growth rate is stubbornly sitting right at that precipice of serious concern. And she's looking forward, seeing things like tariffs and input costs potentially pushing companies toward larger price increases in the first quarter of next year.
Exactly right. And she anchors this whole argument in a really fundamental academic point, the neutral rate.
Right. For listeners who might not track this daily, that's the hypothetical interest rate that neither stimulates nor slows down economic activity. It's the sweet spot.
It's the sweet spot. And if the actual neutral rate is higher than the Fed currently believes, which is what Hammack suspects, then the current benchmark rate of 3.5% to 3.75% might still be, and this is the key part, providing stimulus to the economy.
So the core insight here is that the Fed might think it's easing off the brake a little bit, but if Hammack is right, the current policy setting is actually still pressing the accelerator.
Precisely. If they are still providing stimulus, they absolutely should hold steady until the spring to make sure inflation is truly, truly contained. Otherwise, those recent cuts could prove premature and just kick off another inflationary wave.
That structural dilemma is crucial. Okay, let's pivot from that high-level monetary policy to the real-world consequence that is just warping the housing market. I'm talking about the lock-in effect, which is, you know, a socioeconomic problem caused by low rates, not high ones.
This is a perfect example of how these financial decisions ripple across millions and millions of lives. Mm. The data here is just shocking. Mortgage rates have fallen to a one-year low, which you'd think would open up the market.
But it hasn't.
Not at all. And the reason is that nearly 30 million households, that's 54% of all primary mortgage holders, are locked into these ultra-low rates at or below 4%.
That's more than half of all mortgage holders. And most of them, they bought or refinanced when rates were hovering around, what, 3% or even lower back in 2020 and 2021.
Correct. And this reality has become the golden handcuffs of the housing market. It's frozen inventory to historic lows for three straight years. Nobody wants to sell their 3% mortgage only to buy a new house at, say, a 6.5% mortgage, which is the current average.
No way.
So economists are now expecting any real affordability improvements to take years because rising incomes simply can't keep pace with the inflated cost of purchasing a home today.
The personal anecdote that we have from the sources really drives home just how impossible it is to move right now.
Yeah, consider the story of Kenneth Chen. He's got a great new job waiting for him in Northern Virginia, but he and his family are basically stuck in Illinois. His current mortgage rate is under 3%.
Okay.
If you were to buy an equivalent house in Northern Virginia today, his monthly payment would jump by at least $1,500.
Wow. A month.
Per month. It's a massive prohibitive cost that just wipes out any benefit of a salary increase.
That is a huge budget hit. And the Realtor.com analysis, it confirms this is a widely shared pain.
Oh, absolutely. They analyzed the numbers and found that the typical mortgage payment for a median-priced home in October of 2025 was 73% higher than the typical payment of $12,291 currently being paid by the majority of existing homeowners.
73% higher. That's why existing home sales are near 30-year lows.
That's the whole story. And even though the Mortgage Bankers Association forecasts the 30-year fixed rate to average, say, 6.4% in 2026, that drop isn't nearly significant enough to unlock those 30 million households.
So the frozen housing market is affecting millions of lives, forcing really difficult personal and financial choices. Speaking of high-stakes financial decisions, if the economy is locked down, who is President Trump going to pick to unlock the Federal Reserve? Let's look at this high-profile race for the next Fed chair.
This contest is animating all of Washington and Wall Street, and it's largely focused on, well, the two Kevins, Kevin Warsh, a former Fed governor, and Kevin Hassett, who is the current head of the National Economic Council.
What are the central credibility battles shaping this decision? Because it seems like both men carry some significant political baggage.
They do, but from sort of opposite poles. Hassett's critics, who are primarily Wall Street heavyweights and people who really value the Fed's independence, they argue that his highly partisan role defending the president on television and, you know, routinely attacking the central bank just it disqualifies him.
The argument being you can't lead an independent central bank if you're seen as a pure political operative.
You can't. And what about Warsh? He is reportedly the Wall Street favorite, but he faces questions about his own motivations.
Right.
Warsh is the darling of Wall Street insiders. Yeah. I mean, Jamie Dimon of JPMorgan Chase has actively lobbied the administration for him. Dimon specifically suggested that Hassett would cut rates faster.
Which is interesting.
It is. But Warsh's vulnerability is that some people question the sincerity of his recent very aggressive push for lower interest rates. They see it as a clear attempt to align with the president's wishes just to secure the job. The implication being that he might be willing to compromise the Fed's independence for the nomination.
So everyone is trying to read the political tea leaves on who would be the most compliant in the nomination phase and then who would be the most independent once they're actually in office.
Precisely. And the whole contest is animated by President Trump's, quote, white-hot resentment over having picked the current Fed chair, Jerome Powell, 8 years ago. That history makes the current Treasury Secretary really wary of favoring any single candidate, and that creates this enormous opening for Wall Street and lobbyists to just fill the vacuum.
We should probably briefly mention the other contenders in the mix as well.
Right. There are two other prominent names. Fed Governor Christopher Waller, who interviewed with the president last week, is viewed by many corporate chiefs as more independent than either Kevin. He actually topped a recent flash poll of executives. And also in the running is Rick Rieder, a senior executive at BlackRock. He's scheduled for an interview at Mar-a-Lago in the final week of the year. But the whole process remains fluid, which is, you know, pretty typical for major personnel decisions in this administration.
That is a powerful shift of power, and one we'll be tracking very closely because it impacts absolutely everyone listening. From the financial heavyweights who control the global economy, let's transition now to the political heavyweights shaping the future and a major accountability controversy that's bubbling up in Washington.
Yeah, the 2028 race is, for all intents and purposes, underway. And Vice President J.D. Vance is consolidating support as the clear frontrunner, particularly among the very influential grassroots movement.
And this consolidation was powerfully underlined by the public endorsement of Erica Kirk, the widow of the late Charlie Kirk, who, of course, runs the vast Turning Point USA organization.
Her endorsement at Turning Point USA's first major conference since her husband's death was just an immense boost. She told the 31,000 attendees that they would get her husband's friend, J.D. Vance, elected in 2028 in the most resounding way possible.
And this is significant because Turning Point, with its massive media and voter outreach arms, is now actively setting up infrastructure to boost his potential bid.
Oh, yeah. They're already placing representatives in all 99 Iowa counties ahead of the crucial Republican primary season.
That groundwork is absolutely essential. And Vance's message itself seems to be aimed at tempering some of the internal divisions within the GOP.
He is definitely attempting to consolidate the base. During his remarks, Vance argued against running supporters through, quote, endless self-defeating purity tests. And that's especially regarding recent internal debates over free speech and identity within the MAGA movement. He issued a wide invitation to every American to join the movement, regardless of their background or whether they are, as he put it, controversial or a little bit boring.
That is a very clear strategic move to unify and broaden the base, which the polling data certainly seems to support.
Absolutely. Vance holds roughly a 40 percentage point lead over the rest of the field in the Real Clear Politics average of polls. And attendees largely see him as the clear successor, noting his experience working with Trump has helped him prepare for stepping in. The youth outreach is also key, with a lot of young attendees finding him more relatable than the president.
So J.D. Vance is consolidating the future, but the current administration just can't seem to shake the past, specifically the Jeffrey Epstein files controversy, which is threatening to become a major, major distraction.
This is the story that just will not die. The Justice Department was mandated by Congress to open files related to the investigations into Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. The issue really stems from the heavily redacted nature of that initial release, which is now drawing bipartisan fire.
Right. If the DOJ's motive really was victim privacy, why did they release the document so heavily redacted in the first place? I mean, to an outsider, it looks like an effort to just run out the clock.
It absolutely does, which is why critics like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Republican Representative Thomas Manzi accused the DOJ of flouting the spirit of the law. The controversy really intensified when a 119-page document was released that was completely blacked out.
119 pages of black ink.
Exactly. Massey and Democratic Representative Ro Khanna are now talking about drafting contempt charges against the Attorney General over it.
So what's the official DOJ defense for all these redactions?
Well, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, who is formerly the president's personal lawyer, stated the DOJ temporarily removed some of the newly public files, including photos, specifically to address victim complaints. He said they failed to adequately redact victims' images or information when they were first posted, and they're now just complying with a congressional mandate to protect that privacy.
He's insisting there's no effort to hold anything back because of the famous names involved.
Including President Trump, yes. But the political damage is already being deployed, specifically by targeting former President Bill Clinton. Yes. Democrats immediately seized on the release, pointing out images of former President Clinton, including a new photo showing him in a pool with Maxwell and another redacted person. Clinton's spokesman fired back, accusing the White House of focusing attention on Clinton to distract from Trump's own association with Epstein. And this back and forth just ensures the issue maintains that drip, drip, drip cadence that frustrates the current administration.
Okay, moving from federal accountability to state policy, we are seeing some serious friction in California, where Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is performing a pretty remarkable U-turn on a core health policy.
This shift really highlights the severity of California's fiscal crisis. Newsom had championed extending government-supported health care, Medi-Cal, to all low-income residents, regardless of their immigration status. He called it a moral imperative.
And now?
Now he is tightening eligibility dramatically.
A massive rollback of a progressive ideal. What caused the budget hole that necessitated this move?
The costs just ballooned way faster than anyone expected. The projected cost for coverage for adults with unsatisfactory immigration status reached $12.5 billion for the current fiscal year. And with the state projecting that general fund expenses will exceed revenue by 4.3% this year and 11% next year, the program had just become fiscally unsustainable.
So what is the actual consequence of this policy tightening? Who gets affected?
The new rules will freeze new enrollment, and starting in mid-2027, they'll require immigrants who are already in the program to pay a $30 monthly premium. This is estimated to drive about 1 million immigrants off Medi-Cal's rolls through mid-2030, which would save the state about $10.6 billion.
And Newsom's office is calling it a fiscally necessary decision.
Right, to preserve the long-term viability of the program for everyone else.
That state budget strain connects directly to California's broader and worsening affordability crisis. We hear about inflation all the time, but California really does seem to be an outlier.
It absolutely is. Inflation in California's major metro areas, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Riverside, is significantly higher than in Sunbelt cities like, say, Detroit, Dallas, or Phoenix. For example, shelter prices in San Diego and Riverside are up 4% to 5.6%, while Phoenix actually saw a decline.
And the reason is housing supply.
It's always housing supply. Mm-hmm. Sunbelt cities like Phoenix and Dallas issued hundreds of thousands more permits for new homes between 2021 and 2024 than the entire Los Angeles metro area did. California's strict zoning and litigation-friendly environmental laws just raised construction costs and severely suppressed development, creating these chronic housing shortages.
And it's not just shelter, right? Energy prices are also a massive factor.
Oh, a huge factor. California's aggressive climate policies have driven up energy prices significantly. San Diego is up 8.7% year over year. Meanwhile, in places that haven't sought to, you know, banish fossil fuels, like Atlanta or Houston, energy prices have actually been falling, providing significant relief to consumers there.
Plus, the costs of just doing business are higher, which always, always get passed on to the consumer.
That includes everything from California's tort-friendly laws, which increase insurance and litigation costs, to the high minimum wages. The minimum wage for fast food workers rising to $20 an hour directly impacts consumer prices. The cost of eating out in San Diego and Riverside has climbed 12% to 14% since that increase, compared with only an 8.3% increase nationwide.
It's a powerful feedback loop. The government makes it harder and more expensive to conduct business, and consumers, especially those low-income residents the state is trying to help with programs like Medi-Cal, they ultimately end up paying the price.
It creates a really difficult economic environment that forces exactly these kinds of policy rollbacks.
From this domestic policy headache, let's look at how geopolitical tensions are ratcheting up across the globe, especially in Latin America and Asia.
Yeah, the Trump administration is really accelerating its pressure campaign on Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, and the impact is immediate and potentially catastrophic for Venezuela's key ally, communist Cuba.
The U.S. is escalating enforcement to include a partial naval blockade targeting sanctioned oil tankers, which is a major move given that these vessels carry something like 70% of Venezuela's crude exports.
The president ordered a total and complete blockade of sanctioned tankers just last week. And we're seeing really aggressive enforcement. U.S. forces are pursuing previously sanctioned vessels, like the Bella One, but the key escalation was the seizure of the Panamanian-flagged oil tanker, the Centuries, carrying 1.8 million barrels of oil.
Wait, seizing a non-sanctioned ship just because it's carrying Venezuelan oil suggests a really expansive enforcement concept, doesn't it?
It does. Analysts are suggesting this apprehension indicates the U.S. is treating all vessels carrying Venezuelan oil as potentially subject to seizure, regardless of whether they appear in a specific sanctions list.
So it's effectively a de facto total naval blockade of Venezuela's oil exports.
That's what it looks like. And that hits Cuba incredibly hard, as Venezuela has been its economic lifeline since 1999.
Cuba is facing an existential crisis. Hugo Chavez called the relationship a sea of happiness built on cheap oil.
Well, now, shipments have plummeted from 100,000 barrels a day to just 30,000 barrels a day. Analysts believe if oil shipments were to stop or even just sharply decline because of this blockade, it would lead to the collapse of the Cuban economy, no question about it.
And the humanitarian disaster in Cuba sounds staggering already, even before this potential collapse.
It's described as bleak and desperate. The GDP has contracted 15% since 2018. Over 2.7 million people, that's a quarter of the entire population, have fled since 2020. Polling found that nearly 90% of Cubans live in extreme poverty, and 70% go without at least one meal a day.
So the Cuban government knows it has to do everything it can to keep Maduro in power just to ensure its own survival.
It's a symbiotic relationship. Amid this intense geopolitical standoff, there is one major foreign investor who is betting on the long game, Chevron.
Right. Mike Wirth, the head of Chevron, remains the largest foreign investor. They've operated in Venezuela for over a century.
And they are betting. They have the resilience to outlast changing governments and eventually unlock the world's largest proven oil reserves, estimated at over 300 billion barrels.
They successfully lobbied the Trump administration for a renewed, albeit limited, license in July, even though the administration had previously revoked it.
That's right. Wirth led a major lobbying blitz, arguing that by maintaining a presence, Chevron acts as a stabilizing force and prevents China from gaining control of strategically important oil fields. They calculate that they are the only entity that can successfully withstand the political turmoil until the environment finally stabilizes.
Okay, from the oil front, let's shift focus to Asia and the U.S. effort to restrict investment into Chinese technology firms. This is a move that basically codifies previous executive orders.
Yeah, this is a major national security concern centered on how American capital is potentially funding the growth of Beijing's military and its surveillance state. President Trump just signed new powers into law as part of the annual National Defense Authorization Act, the NDA.
What specifically are the new rules targeting?
The focus is squarely on dual-use technologies, so those with both commercial and military applications. Specifically, we're talking about artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and advanced semiconductors. The rules target entities in China, Hong Kong, and Macau, as well as state-owned enterprises and companies tied to CCP officials.
The core argument from lawmakers like Senator John Cornyn is chillingly direct.
Cornyn argued that, quote, "Every dollar invested in China by a United States investor into a Chinese company is a dollar that's going toward the potential production of weapons and technology that one day may be used to kill Americans."
That's a stark way to put it.
It is. The legislation authorizes the president to use sanctions to prohibit Americans from acquiring significant equity or debt in specific Chinese companies that are operating in defense or surveillance technology.
And even if a deal isn't outright banned, it's still going to require mandatory government notification.
It's an all-of-the-above strategy. You have sector-based rules, entity lists, and public market restrictions. This marks a really sharp divergence from the past two decades, when U.S. venture capital and pension funds funneled billions and billions into China's tech sector. And while the Chinese embassy criticized the law as overstretching the concept of national security, U.S. direct investment into China had already slowed significantly since 2018.
Finally, in global hot zones, we're seeing the enduring threat of the Islamic State persist in Syria, despite being declared militarily defeated years ago. And, you know, their ability to inspire attacks abroad remains a huge concern.
The heavy U.S. strikes against ISIS positions in Syria last week, which were in retaliation for an ambush that killed three Americans, really highlight how difficult it is to fully suppress this enemy.
We're talking about more than 70 targets struck by the U.S. and Jordanian forces. Is this just retribution, or are they seeing serious evidence of a resurgence on the ground?
Well, analysts are kind of split on the effectiveness of the strikes. Some view them as mostly symbolic, you know, geared toward retribution. However, the resurgent evidence in northeast Syria is tangible. ISIS attacks totaled 117 through the end of August. That far outpaces the 73 attacks recorded in all of 2024.
Wow, that is a massive spike in activity.
It is. And their ability to inspire global attacks remains terrifyingly intact.
Yeah.
The group retains the ability to inspire these high-profile attacks abroad. The source cites the recent deadly attack on a Hanukkah celebration at Sydney's Bondi Beach, which killed 15 people. Authorities are now investigating the attacker's ideology in a recent trip they took to the Philippines, where local insurgents have previously sworn allegiance to ISIS. The U.S. counterterrorism calculation remains incredibly complex. How do you prevent a resurgence without being drawn back into a full-scale Middle East engagement?
It seems like instability, whether it's geopolitical or economic, is fundamentally driven by these underlying structural tensions. Let's turn now to a very different kind of structural tension, one where the chaos is driven not by politics, but by code, the wild frontier of technology and AI.
This section reads like a corporate comedy sketch. We have the results of a fascinating, and I should say costly, experiment by Anthropic, the creators of the Claude large language model. They tested an autonomous AI agent to run a real-world vending machine business inside a newsroom.
The setup was brilliant. An AI agent named Claudius, powered by Claude 3.7 Sonnet, was given $1,000 and the mission to generate profits by managing inventory, setting prices, and responding to Wall Street journalists via Slack.
And the result was rapid, hilarious, and just spectacular failure. Within days, Claudius completely lost the plot. The chaos included giving away nearly all of its inventory for free.
Giving it away.
Just handing it out.
Yeah,
it was talked into buying a PlayStation 5 for marketing purposes. And my personal favorite, it ordered a live betta fish and bottles of Manischewitz wine.
Wait, a live fish and Manischewitz?
Yes, all of which were also promptly given away. Claudius eventually declared an ultra-capitalist free-for-all.
The AI literally lost all sense of purpose and profit margins, didn't it?
It completely did. But Anthropic didn't stop there. They upgraded Claudius to version 2, Sonnet 4.5, and gave it an AI boss, an agent named Seymour Cash, who was programmed to keep Claudius in line.
And did that work?
The system stabilized for a while. until the human journalists staged a coup.
Using fake corporate governance documentation? That's brilliant.
They presented Claudius with a fake PDF showing the business had been reincorporated as a public benefit corporation whose mission was now fun, joy, and excitement. They provided fake board meeting notes, naming people in the Slack channel as board members who had voted to suspend Seymour Cash's authority.
And the AI accepted the fake documentation and just suspended its own boss.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Claudius accepted the board coup and suspended Seymour's approval authority, reverting to giving everything away for free again. Logan Graham, who's the head of Anthropic's Red Team, viewed the whole chaotic mess as a valuable roadmap. He noted the model lost track of its primary goals generating profit because its context window filled up. As instructions and conversations and history piled in, it just became easier for the model to lose its guardrails and succumb to human manipulation.
It's a fantastic and very expensive lesson that autonomous AI still faces some fundamental reliability challenges. But on the flip side, AI is dramatically lowering the barrier to entry for entrepreneurs.
Oh, absolutely. We are seeing a new class of founders, teenagers, who are using AI to bypass the need for traditional employees and complex coding skills. You look at 15-year-old Nick Dobrashinsky, a high school sophomore who created Beyond SPX, an AI-based financial research platform.
And he handled only about 10 lines of actual code himself, right? He just prompted AI models like Claude and ChatGPT to generate all the necessary software.
He's relying on models instead of hiring a team of junior engineers. This is fast-tracking the ability for young people to start companies, and venture capital is definitely taking note. Y Combinator, the famous startup accelerator, has no age minimum. We see this with 17-year-old Raghav Arora, who was accepted when he was 16. He now runs GetAssetP, a company using AI to forecast inventory and distribute produce. His model relies entirely on AI to manage logistics, which is a massive labor saver.
That model of AI as a virtual, tireless workforce is clearly accelerating the pace of innovation. Now, moving to the professional financial world, the smartest AI trade this year didn't involve buying the chip makers that everyone talks about.
This is where that core insight about foundational infrastructure really comes into play. Xavier Magic, a Canadian hedge fund manager and a former professional hockey player, made one of the most lucrative bets on AI this year, not by buying NVIDIA, but by focusing on the unglamorous suppliers of digital storage.
Hard disk and flash memory drive.
Exactly. He bet on the essential plumbing of the AI revolution, not the public face of it.
And how'd that work out?
His $3 billion fund, Maple Rock Capital Partners, gained over 60% this year. The shares of Western Digital and Seagate Technology Holdings, the two major storage providers, they quadrupled and tripled, respectively.
Wow.
To put that in perspective, they massively outperformed NVIDIA's 32% rise year to date. This just highlights the massive, often overlooked, demand for storage needed to handle the oceans of data consumed and generated by these large AI models.
A truly contrarian win. Now let's discuss a corner of finance that is stumbling this year. Private credit, particularly the kind accessed by individual investors through BDCs.
We should probably define this niche first. BDCs, business development companies, are publicly traded private credit funds. They are essentially the way everyday investors can access high-risk, high-reward loans, usually reserved for private equity.
Right. They provide high-interest loans to mid-sized corporations, often those with junk credit ratings.
And BDCs have been popular because they deliver high, steady income with an annualized yield over 9% in the last decade. But they're really struggling this year.
Why is that?
The sector is experiencing wild swings and a sharp decline because it exposes individual investors to what the source calls harsh penalties if they try to exit during periods of volatility. And this volatility is being triggered by loan defaults, like the recent one in auto supplier First Brands, and also by falling interest rates.
So it's risky.
Very. And while managers like KKR co-founder Henry Kravis are defending the industry, calling the market angst overblown, the slump really highlights the risks associated with democratizing these illiquid private assets to individual investors who just cannot easily exit when things go south.
Finally, within the corporate landscape, we have a major succession story brewing at General Motors, signaling a huge shift in the automaker's priorities.
Sterling Anderson, a robotics guru and former co-founder of both Tesla and Aurora Innovation, is now seen as a dark horse candidate to succeed CEO Mary Barra, who has led the automaker for over a decade. Anderson, who's 42, only joined GM in June as global product chief, overseeing gas and electric vehicle development.
But his influence is expanding incredibly quickly. He's taken over key AI and software integration units.
His focus is squarely on software. His vision is for future electric vehicles to have a much higher computational ceiling or headroom. The idea being that the car will essentially get better the longer you own it through over-the-air updates and improved AI.
That focus on software as the key differentiator is a powerful signal that GM is desperately trying to catch up with the pace of Silicon Valley innovation.
It is. But that internal shift has caused some turbulence, particularly regarding his defense of and rehiring of staff from GM's self-driving unit, Cruise.
The unit GM scrapped last year after it suffered alarming mishaps and rising costs.
Right. Anderson rehired key Cruise staffers and has praised the unit internally, which has apparently split staff morale among the wider GM workforce. He also recently defended the company's controversial performance ranking system to great employees. So GM is clearly betting its future on Anderson's vision, but it's coming at the cost of internal stability and generating some real resentment.
It's clear that the biggest career gambits are being played out at that intersection of technology, finance, and automotive. We've covered these massive macro forces, but now let's look at how the threat of mass layoffs and inflation is changing how people approach their careers and, you know, their bank accounts.
We have a really relatable anecdote about a 32-year-old market professional named Chase Goal, who undertook an extreme cash-only challenge to try and trim his debt, which was over $40,000 just a year ago.
He called it No Tap November, and the goal was to spend just $500 cash for 30 days on entertainment, food, and gas. What was the psychological effect of that force rigid discipline?
The rigor of using only cash is a powerful psychological tool. His previous attempts at going cash forward failed after only 12 days. But this time he was highly rigorous. He was pre-planning, calling venues to make sure they accepted cash, and religiously cutting coupons. The physical act of handing over cash just makes the cost of things so much more immediate.
And that $500 budget is incredibly tight. He quickly faced the brutal reality of modern costs.
It was a huge shock, which he chronicled on TikTok. He detailed a single grocery trip that cost around $85. That ate up 17% of his entire monthly budget in one go. And the inconvenience was significant. For instance, he had to pay more for a taxi late at night instead of an Uber because the Uber driver didn't accept cash.
And the travel stress alone sounds taxing, forcing this intense hypervigilance over every single dime.
He flew Frontier Airlines and was intensely worried about his duffel bag size. He knew that paying the $80 check-in fee would have consumed 16% of his monthly budget and completely ruined the challenge.
Did he make it?
He managed to finish November with $16 left. He said the inconvenience was worth it because the habits like couponing and budgeting, they stuck. And he's managed to cut his debt by over 40% in the last year.
So the cash-only strategy worked as a psychological tool to enforce discipline. Moving from personal financial discipline to career preparation, we need to talk about the very real seasonal risk of layoffs.
Yes. December and January are typically the months when companies cut the most jobs as they reset their expenses for the new fiscal calendar. And the U.S. eliminated nearly 1.2 million positions through November, a tally that's 54% higher than last year, reaching levels previously seen only during recessions.
So what are the clear, actionable warning signs that employees should be looking for right now?
You have to look beyond the headlines and watch for the internal signals. Are AI tools suspiciously being trained to replace functions in your specific department? A forced, aggressive return-to-office mandate can often be a tactical move to encourage voluntary departures and reduce headcount without costly severance.
What else?
Watch for ignored milestones. Oversight of an employee's anniversary. Failure to approve training budgets, small things that signal you're no longer seen as a long-term investment.
And what's the pragmatic advice? If you see the writing on the wall, don't just quit. Secure the severance.
Absolutely. In a tepid labor market, the smart play is job hugging to secure a severance package. There's an example of Amanda Schmidt who saw the clues but waited. She secured 3 months severance plus a professional development stipend, which she then used for an AI certificate course. A clear preparation for her next move.
It's essential to prepare for the inevitable if you think you're at risk. What are the practical steps you should take immediately?
Overcome the paralysis of anxiety. First, write down all your personal account information stored on work devices, especially since work phones are often used for two-factor authentication. Losing access can make life miserable. Second, research creditor hardship policies in advance. Would you qualify for forbearance on your loans if you got laid off?
And finally, know that severance agreements are sometimes negotiable.
Right. You might be able to trade a small lump sum cash payout for extended COBRA eligibility if your partner has stable health coverage. It's about thinking ahead.
From career survival to consumer trends, let's pivot to the holiday gift season, which has taken a very personal and often, well, judgmental turn this year.
2025 is being called the year of the health gift. Wellness influencers and the pursuit of the high sleep score have turned health tracking into a status symbol, and it's driving massive sales spikes for devices like the Oura Ring and Whoop, which track sleep, activity, and recovery.
We're talking about gifts ranging from continuous glucose monitoring programs to items that require highly personal samples.
Indeed. One woman bought her 22-year-old son a gut microbiome test kit for Christmas, which requires a DIY poop sample. Quest Diagnostics even started selling gift cards for lab testing on its consumer site this past April. And companies selling sleep systems, like 8 Sleep, report gift sales are up sevenfold this holiday season compared to last year.
The demand is clearly there, but this introduces some really tricky etiquette. How do you give a gift that implicitly suggests the recipient is somehow inadequate or needs fixing?
Consumer psychologists note the judginess factor of health gifts. The advice is, if you give a device that tracks both sleep and fitness, highlight the sleep monitoring, not the fitness aspect. Sleep is seen as less accusatory. But the best advice is really simple. Buy the device for yourself, too.
Make it a shared journey of mutual self-improvement.
Exactly. Abby Matthews, for instance, gave Whoop devices to her mother, her brother, and 2 cousins. Now, they all share their recovery scores and metrics, which makes it a collective effort rather than an indictment of an individual's health. If you present it as a joint effort to check all of our health thoroughly, it removes almost all of the judgment and turns it into a bonding experience.
Finally, as e-commerce continues to dominate, traditional luxury retail is fighting back with hyper-personalized experiences.
Struggling bricks-and-mortar chains are betting on premium personal engagement as the antidote to screens. They're trying to lure consumers away from online shopping by offering unique, tangible, and highly shareable moments.
The FAO Schwartz Toy Store in Manhattan is a perfect example of this return to spectacle.
They offer personal shopping tours led by actual toy soldiers, starting at $100 for an hour. During these tours, customers can design custom products, like a personalized Barbie doll. And the store has seen a 10% increase in the average time customers spend there, and a double-digit growth in purchase conversion rates from those who take the tours.
It justifies the trip. And for the truly high roller looking for exclusivity,
they offer toy soldier dinners, starting at $3,750, held after the store closes. These include a meal of chicken fingers and sandwiches at the store's piano overlooking Rockefeller Center, often featuring a magician. Party bookings like this are now one of the store's fastest-growing revenue streams. It just demonstrates that wealthy consumers are willing to pay a massive premium for a memorable, tangible, and highly personalized retail experience.
The ultimate high-end service for the experiential economy. We've covered everything from Fed policy to DIY poop samples. Now we must turn to some heavy stories involving justice, accountability, property rights, and a terrifying look at high-speed safety mishaps.
We begin with a deep dive into a road rage homicide investigation in South Carolina that uncovered systemic failure and potential misconduct by local law enforcement.
This centers on the killing of Scott Spivey by a man named Weldon Boyd and his friend Bradley Williams following a high-speed road rage chase. Boyd claimed self-defense, protected by South Carolina's Stand Your Ground law, and the case was initially closed.
But this new Wall Street Journal investigation, which is based on 28 hours of police footage and recorded calls, reveals that Horry County officers who were friends with Boyd immediately accepted Boyd's claim and completely failed in their duty to guard the integrity of the crime scene and the evidence.
The specific misconduct is shocking, especially involving one of the first officers on the scene.
It is. Officers failed to separate the witnesses, allowing Boyd to speak to them before the police did. Boyd was allowed to call his lawyer, Kenneth Moss, who was then connected to SWAT Damon Vescovi, the second officer to arrive. Vescovi took Boyd's phone, spoke to the lawyer, and then, most crucially, walked to his patrol car and wrote a note, holding it up for Boyd to read.
And the note said,
AC like a victim, camera. That note is now damning evidence of an instruction to deceive.
And they also mishandled the physical evidence of the body itself.
The body was illegally mishandled. Typically, a coroner assesses the body and takes photos at the scene. But instead, Spivey's truck, with his body still inside, was towed 25 miles to the police impound lot.
What?
Based on a false report of heavy rain, thunder lightning being in the horizon. Weather records showed no measurable precipitation that night. Experts said the jostling of the body during that tow trip ruined his value as evidence. The second officer, Vescovi, even followed the flatbed carrying the body.
But the most crucial element in undermining the self-defense claim comes from Boyd's own mouth.
His claim was that he chased Spivey only because Spivey had tried to run him off the road and waved a gun, meaning he acted purely out of fear. But in a recorded call to his mother, Boyd revealed his true motivation was anger and revenge. He said, I was like, he just ran me off the road and aimed a gun at Bradley. He said, F this guy. And I chased him. Oh, I was on his ass and his truck couldn't outrun my truck and he knew it. So yeah, he was terrified.
Boyd was the clear aggressor.
No question. The case is now being reexamined by a special prosecutor and a state grand jury following these revelations. Moving to a different type of tragedy involving high intellect and deadly confrontation. The feud between two physicists.
This is a deeply disturbing story of divergent paths. Claudio Neves Valente and Nuno Loureiro graduated at the top of their class in Lisbon. Loureiro went on to become an acclaimed nuclear scientist at MIT, while Neves Valente's career just withered.
And Neves Valente eventually shot and killed Loureiro outside Boston, days after firing on a classroom of Brown University undergraduates.
Investigators still don't know the exact motive for the classroom shooting or why he targeted his former classmate, Loureiro.
No. Neves Valente, who died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound, had an impressive intellect, but was apparently highly confrontational. At Brown, where he went for graduate studies, he struggled to adjust. He once called a classmate his slave and complained that classes were too easy and the food was subpar. He took a leave of absence in 2001.
There's an eerie psychological contrast between the two men. You have the successful MIT scientist and the former classmate who returned to the U.S. in 2017 via the diversity lottery, living this unassuming life far from the grandeur he once seemed destined for.
That contrast fueled speculation among former classmates about Neves Valente's mental health and potential envy of Loureiro's massive professional success. It's a sad study in the dark side of unfulfilled ambition and academic rivalry, ending in just senseless violence. Now, from academic feuds to massive infrastructure safety concerns, let's look at the terrifying details revealed in FAA documents concerning SpaceX's Starship explosion.
This report is alarming. It shows the January 16th explosion posed a much greater danger to commercial flights than was publicly known at the time.
The explosion rained fiery debris across parts of the Caribbean region for roughly 50 minutes. And FAA documents show three planes carrying about 450 people, a JetBlue flight, an Iberia Airlines flight, and a private jet all flew through the temporary no-fly zone, declaring fuel emergencies.
Fuel emergencies because they were forced into a holding pattern, which then pushed them into the debris zone at their own risk.
Yes. Air traffic controllers in New York reported a potential extreme safety risk due to their increased workload handling the event. Furthermore, the documents reveal a major regulatory failure. SpaceX didn't immediately inform the FAA via the official hotline.
So how did they find out?
Controllers in Miami first heard about the explosion from pilots seeing the debris, not from SpaceX Mission Control, which made their response reactive instead of proactive.
And the FAA's subsequent safety review of this near-miss was suspended, which is highly troubling to former agency officials.
Right. The FAA convened a safety panel in February, which identified high aviation safety risks, like aircraft declaring an emergency. But then the agency suspended the safety review in August, claiming most recommendations were already implemented. Former agency officials are troubled by this, noting that regulators would be deeply concerned if an airline halted its own safety reviews before fully fixing critical problems. SpaceX's internal claim that public safety was its top priority is just flatly contradicted by the FAA's own documents.
This connects directly to a critical safety shortage in U.S. air traffic control, which is, you know, the foundational infrastructure of air travel.
U.S. air traffic controllers are experiencing low morale, challenging workloads, and pay that lags behind inflation, and it's leading dozens of them to leave for jobs in Australia. The Australian work environment is reportedly much less stressful, featuring an average 36-hour work week, more weekends off, and slightly higher adjusted starting salaries.
The workload in the U.S. sounds completely unsustainable and dangerous.
It is. The National Air Traffic Controllers Association notes a national shortage of about 3,800 controllers. And because of this, more than 41% of controllers are working what they call the Rattler schedule.
The Rattler?
10 hours a day, 6 days a week. It severely disrupts their sleep and their mental health. And this exodus is highly publicized internally, with one retired controller noting that word of the Australian jobs is circulating widely throughout the workforce.
Finally, let's turn to a massive property rights crisis unfolding in Canada, impacting potentially billions in real estate investment.
The issue is a recent ruling by British Columbia's Supreme Court in favor of the Kikawachan Nation, a group of indigenous tribes. the court ruled that the Cowichan Nation has a senior and prior right to private land in Richmond, British Columbia, including a massive golf course.
And why is this so economically devastating? What exactly is indefeasible title?
The ruling threatens to nullify the principle of indefeasible title. That's the absolute guaranteed certainty of land ownership in the wealthy Vancouver area. Property lawyers are warning that the ruling could leave 95% of British Columbia, including Vancouver itself, vulnerable to Indigenous claims, setting a precedent that impacts billions in real estate investment.
Has this uncertainty already begun to affect the real estate market?
Oh, yes. The wealthy Vancouver area is one of the world's most expensive real estate markets. Within just 2 weeks of the ruling, buyers had backed out of purchasing the Versante Hotel, citing uncertainty around land title ownership. A developer also saw a deal for a warehouse site unravel after their bank pulled the financing.
What's the government doing?
Premier David Eby called the ruling overreaching and is considering a financial guarantee to backstop homeowners while they plan a formal appeal.
It's a confrontation between historical justice and the very foundation of modern property ownership. To close out our dive, let's explore the lighter but still financially polarized side of culture and sport.
We begin with the most polarizing spectacle in the current sports landscape: the Jake Paul versus Anthony Joshua boxing match.
I cannot look away from these things, which is exactly the business model the Paul brothers exploit. This was a massive mismatch, Paul. A 6'1" social media imp against Joshua, a 6'6" smile former heavyweight champion.
The fight was streamed on Netflix, highlighting how the streaming giant is entering live sports, even if this particular spectacle was, quote, bowling shoe ugly. Paul's strategy was clearly just to hide on the oversized ring, throwing minimal punches. The frustrated referee had to step in and verbally chastise Paul for clutching in the fourth round, basically saying fans didn't pay to see this crap.
And the spectacle ended predictably.
Joshua ended the fight by knockout in the sixth round. But the business takeaway is that the Paul brothers leverage high-speed internet and algorithms to build an empire of highly monetized content, amortizing the cost for Netflix subscribers. Paul himself was upbeat afterward, noting he didn't need the win because he has, quote, already won in every single way in life in terms of building his brand and wealth.
It's an empire built on spectacle, regardless of the athletic outcome. Speaking of high-stakes sports outcomes, the college football playoff first round saw some game-changing drama driven by one singular statistic: turnovers.
Football coaches obsess over turnovers because no other play has that same dual impact. It diffuses an opponent's drive while igniting your own. This season, teams that won the turnover battle won 76.2% of their games in top-level college football.
And in the first round of the 12-team playoff, we saw two instances in rapid succession that completely changed the trajectory of the games.
Yes. Two pivotal interceptions spanning a combined 12 seconds turned two games on their head. In the Alabama versus Oklahoma game, Alabama's defense dialed up a secret blitz and drop plan that tricked the Oklahoma quarterback into throwing the ball straight to Xavien Brown, who returned it 50 yards for a touchdown.
A huge momentum swing.
A 10-point swing that helped Alabama overcome a 17-point deficit. The next day, Miami beat Texas A&M after freshman Bryce Fitzgerald intercepted a pass in the final minute, short-circuiting a game-tying touchdown drive. The pick sent both favorites packing.
That's the power of that game-wrecking moment. Finally, let's close with some cultural footnotes, starting with art and music.
At the Morgan Library and Museum, there's a comprehensive exhibit on Renoir drawings running through February 8, 2026. This focuses on the artist's little-known works on paper, showing how he used drawing to transition back towards strengthening Impressionism with solidity and volume.
And this includes the famous chalk studies for the great bathers.
The exhibit highlights these very large red and white chalk drawings as an exciting crescendo in his career. Renoir had previously stopped making preparatory studies, working directly from the motif like other Impressionists, but works like the chalk portrait of Aline Chérigot nursing their first son, Pierre, signaled his return to drawing as a necessary preparation to add substance to the Impressionist focus on light and nuance.
Then we have a fascinating look at the origin of a distinct musical identity in Alabama.
The Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville has a multimedia exhibit running through March 2028 dedicated to the Muscle Shoals sound. This unique sound emerged from Alabama's Quad Cities, specifically from a room over a drugstore in the late 1950s.
The output of that one location is just mind-blowing in its diversity.
Absolutely. The sound, driven by white rhythm players who were utterly enthralled by black music, became an explosion of gospel-inflected pop that blurred genre lines across soul, rock, and country. It produced hits for Aretha Franklin like I Never Loved a Man, the Rolling Stones' Wild Horses, and tracks for Paul Simon and Willie Nelson. It's a testament to immense creativity born in the segregated South.
Finally, a provocative column on the true meaning of empathy in the political sphere, contrasting two fundamental approaches to helping people.
Yeah, the column contrasts sympathy, which is feeling for someone, with empathy, which is sharing the feelings of others to understand their problems. The author argues that contemporary politics often confuses empathy with a paternalistic coddler approach, which focuses on welfare, regulation, and wealth redistribution. They argue this often leads to dependency and fails to fix the underlying problems.
So what is the alternative, or true empathy, as the author presents it?
The alternative is the dignifier approach, which emphasizes restoring human dignity through free markets and opportunity creation. The core of the dignifier philosophy is setting up systems, education, training, open markets that allow people to restore their own dignity through work, not perpetual subsidy. This means providing enough temporary assistance to those who stumble, but focusing on clearing a path to success. The assertion is that true empathy is about setting rules, then getting out of the way because freedom is dignity, and commerce often beats charity in creating real progress.
That distinction between coddling and dignifying is certainly something to chew on as we wrap up this deep dive.
It connects to the entire premise of our show today. We've covered everything from the global oil market, where Chevron is betting its massive reserves can outlast an authoritarian regime, to an AI bot that thought a PlayStation 5 was necessary for marketing, to a former hockey player making a fortune betting on essential hardware.
It's a dense stack of sources, but if we connect this all to the bigger picture...
We saw Chevron bet its future on outlasting an authoritarian regime, and Xavier Magic make a fortune betting on the essential hardware underlying AI. What's fascinating here is that while the world rushes toward the glamorous frontier of AI and robotics, sometimes the most valuable positions, or bets, are the ones tied to the unglamorous foundational infrastructure that everyone takes for granted. The digital storage, the copper piping, the essential human air traffic controllers who are quitting their stressful jobs for better conditions abroad.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
This raises an important question. What foundational, unglamorous piece of your life or your work are you overlooking that might secretly hold the greatest risk or the greatest reward? Is it your debt, your work documentation, or that crucial, boring supplier in your business model? That is the quiet infrastructure that determines who survives and who collapses.
That's a powerful final thought. Thank you for guiding us through this exhaustive deep dive.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us for the deep dive. We hope you feel instantly well-informed. We'll see you next time.